Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we go from Hemingway Zero to Hemingway Hero in 16 books flat. 15 to go. One down, 15 to go. That's pretty exciting. I really loved The Open Boat. I'm so glad we started with that book. And I just really hope that the list continues to be as good. I kind of have confidence that it will, right? Because, like, Hemingway, I don't know. I've got confidence in his taste. I think he has good taste. So I reckon we are in for an absolute treat. I'm especially confident about the next book that we are going to be starting today because it is another Stephen Crane book. As you most likely know, we will be reading The Blue Hotel. There's a Chris Isaak song called The Blue Hotel. And every time I say the words The Blue Hotel, I can just hear him in his Chris Isaak voice going, Blue Hotel, which is the chorus. He just does that over and over. He does it better than that, but you get the gist. Anyway, The Blue Hotel. This is awesome. Before we jump in and read the first chapter, there was a really cool little article linked in the subreddit, the Hemingway List subreddit, by the Reddit user Jinx Lumos, which was Hemingway's Four Rules for Writing. And it was a really simple little list, very digestible. I'm going to read it to you because it was quite cool. And I want to see if these four rules are reflected throughout the stories that Hemingway has chosen. Hemingway's Four Rules for Writing Well. Simple genius, that's the best way to describe the writing style of Ernest Hemingway. Some writers love to fill their prose with flowery adjectives or complex descriptions that run on and on, but not old Ernie. He wrote simply and clearly, and reading him is like eating a meal of meat and potatoes that tastes better than anything you could order at a five-star restaurant. A key moment in Hemingway's development into one of the great American writers came in 1917. Then a fresh-faced reporter at the Kansas City Star, Hemingway was taught four basic rules of writing that he would carry with him for the rest of his life. Because the list of rules is so short and yet so insightful, it is a must-read for anyone interested in writing effectively. Number 1. Use short sentences. Shorter sentences are easier to digest, and they make it easier to follow each point of an argument or story. Very cool. Number 2. Use short first paragraphs. See the opening post. So using short first paragraph makes it easy to lead you into the chapter or the story. I'm guilty of using a big long winding paragraph or sentence at the opening of my current novel that I'm writing. It goes for like 30 words or something. But I've just come out of reading Tolstoy, and his sentences go for, no exaggeration, I think some of his sentences go for like 150 words. Like, they just go on and on and on. It's insane. So I don't feel too bad. Rule number 3. Use vigorous English. Described by David Garfinkel, vigorous English means it's muscular, forceful writing. Vigorous English comes from passion, focus, and intention. I like that. Passion, focus, and intention. It also says that you should do your homework, and when you know what you're writing about, it's a lot easier to write with authority and vigor. And the last of the four rules is this: be positive, not negative, which basically means you should say what something is rather than what it isn't. Instead of saying something is inexpensive, you should say it is affordable. Instead of describing something as unclear, you should say it is confusing. Well, that makes sense. It's more direct, isn't it? It's more... there's slightly, microscopically, less to untangle in the sentence. It makes the sentence unravel in a less kinked way. And that's always good. The smoother your sentences, the better. That is a very minuscule way to smooth out a sentence, but every little bit counts. So, those are the four rules. Use short sentences, use short first paragraphs, use vigorous English, and be positive, not negative. I just want to see if we can see that echoed throughout these stories that have been recommended to us by the great man. All right. Now, we have, we have put out a vote for what will be the fourth book, right? Because Blue Hotel is only going to go for until January 17th, so that's not long. And then Dubliners will end on February 4th. So we've got less than a month until we start the fourth book. We are just going to be churning through these books. I feel like we've lined up all the short ones right at the start here, which might be a mistake, because short ones can be sort of refreshing, like when you come out of an especially long one, a little short story or something like that can feel like it's more approachable. And we're kind of getting them all out of the way up front. I didn't really mean to do that. I didn't realize how short Dubliners was. I knew it was an anthology of short stories. But I didn't realize that it was itself a really short book. Anyway, doesn't matter. Those are the first three. And there is a vote open currently for what will be number four. There is a pretty clear leader at this point. But I'm going to keep it open for another day or so. Until I stop seeing votes coming in, and then I will declare the winner in the next 2 or 3 days. So, yeah, jump over and get your vote in. I think let's just jump in and read the first chapter of The Blue Hotel, shall we? Why not? I'm really excited. I shouldn't say this because we've got a lot of reading ahead of us, but I've just got this gut feeling that this story, The Blue Hotel, is going to be my favourite story on the whole list. That's a pretty big call, but I'm just saying that straight up front. I hope I'm wrong. I mean, I do hope that I enjoy it. I'm sure I will enjoy it, but it would kind of suck if the second book in was the favourite and it was all downhill from there. I'm ready to be pleasantly surprised. Okay. The Blue Hotel by Stephen Crane. Chapter 1. The Palace Hotel at Fort Romper was painted a light blue, a shade that is on the legs of a kind of heron, causing the bird to declare its position against any background. The Palace Hotel, then, was always screaming and howling in a way that made the dazzling winter nightscape of Nebraska seem only a grey, swampish hush. It stood alone on the prairie, and when the snow was falling, the town 200 yards away was not visible. But when the traveller alighted on the railway station, he was obliged to pass the Palace Hotel before he could come upon the company of low, clapboard houses which composed Fort Romper. And it was not to be thought that any traveller could pass the Palace Hotel without looking at it. Pat Scully, the proprietor, had proved himself a master of strategy when he chose his paints. It is true that on clear days, when the great transcontinental express long lines of swaying pullmans swept through Fort Romper, passengers were overcome at the sight, and the colt that knows the brown reds and the subdivisions of the dark greens of the east expressed shame, pity, horror in a laugh. But to the citizens of this prairie town, and to the people who would naturally stop there, Pat Scully had performed a feat. With this opulence and splendour, these creeds, classes, egotisms that streamed through Romper on the rails day after day, they had no colour in common. As if the displayed delights of such a blue hotel were not sufficiently enticing, it was Scully's habit to go every morning and evening to meet the leisurely trains that stopped at Romper, and work his seductions upon any man that he might see wavering, gripsack in hand. One morning, when a snow-crusted engine dragged its long string of freight cars and its one passenger coach to the station, Scully performed the marvel of catching three men. One was a shaky and quick-eyed Swede, with a great shining cheap valise. One was a tall, bronzed cowboy, who was on his way to a ranch near the Dakota line. One was a silent little man from the east, who who didn't look it and didn't announce it. Scully practically made them prisoners. He was so nimble and merry and kindly that each probably felt it would be the height of brutality to try to escape. They trudged off over the creaking board sidewalks in the wake of the eager little Irishman. He wore a heavy fur cap squeezed tightly down on his head. It caused his two red ears to stick out stiffly, as if they were made of tin. At last, Scully elaborately, with boisterous hospitality, conducted them through the portals of the Blue Hotel. The room which they entered was small. It seemed to be merely a proper temple for an enormous stove, which in the centre was humming with godlike violence. At various points on its surface, the iron had become luminous and glowed yellow from the heat. Beside the stove, Scully's son Johnny was playing high five with an old farmer who had whiskers both grey and sandy. They were quarrelling. Frequently, the old farmer turned his face towards a box of sawdust, coloured brown from tobacco juice, that was behind the stove and spat with an air of great impatience and irritation. With a loud flourish of words, Scully destroyed the game of cards and bustled his son upstairs with part of the baggage of the new guests. He himself conducted them to three basins of the coldest water in the world. The cowboy and the easterner burnished themselves fiery red with this water until it seemed to be some kind of a metal polish. The Swede, however, merely dipped his fingers gingerly and with trepidation. It was notable that throughout the series of small ceremonies, the three travellers were made to feel that Scully was very benevolent. He was conferring great favours upon them. He handed the towel from one to the other with an air of philanthropic impulse. Afterwards they went to the first room, and sitting about the stove, listened to Scully's officious clamour at his daughters, who were preparing the midday meal. They reflected in the silence of experienced men who tread carefully amid new people. Nevertheless, the old farmer, stationary, invisible in his chair near the warmest part of the stove, turned his face from the sawdust box frequently and addressed a glowing commonplace to the strangers. Usually he was answered in short but adequate sentences by either the cowboy or the easterner. The Swede said nothing. He seemed to be occupied in making furtive estimates of each man in the room. One might have thought that he had the sense of silly suspicion which comes to guilt. He resembled a badly frightened man. Later, at dinner, he spoke a little, addressing his conversation entirely to Scully. He volunteered that he had come from New York, where for 10 years he had worked as a tailor. These facts seemed to strike Scully as fascinating, and afterwards he volunteered that he had lived at Romper for 14 years. The Swede asked about the crops and the price of labour. He seemed barely to listen to Scully's extended replies. His eyes continued to rove from man to man. Finally, with a laugh and a wink, he said that some of these Western communities were very dangerous, and after his statement he straightened his legs under the table, tilted his head, and laughed again loudly. It was plain that the demonstration had no meaning to the others. They looked at him, wondering and in silence. All right, there we go. Chapter one down. First thoughts is it is a very different prose style to The Open Boat, isn't it? I wouldn't go as far as to say it feels like a different author or anything like that. It still has a pretty distinctive Crane flavour to it, but he's definitely flexing a different muscle here, a different literary muscle with this writing. And I like it. It flows very, very easily. This chapter was extremely easy to read. I think this chapter was easier to read out loud, without stumbling over my words too much, than any of the chapters in The Open Boat. I'd certainly say it's less poetic and less flowery, floral kind of language. Not that the open boat was overly poetic or floral, but this is just even less. And it's a bit more sort of straightforward speak, which I like. I think that's a good thing. It's a bit like we actually were just talking about with Hemingway's advice, that kind of meat and potatoes, right? You can't beat it. Just meat and potatoes. That actually made me hungry. Damn it. All right. Very cool first chapter. I really enjoyed that. I will open a discussion forum about this chapter on the subreddit. Get over to reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist and have your say about this chapter. Thank you all very much for listening today, and I'll see you tomorrow.